Follow that. It's great to be here. It's my second time here. I read Ashwagandha the first time round many years ago when I published my selected poems, Ashwagandha, in Irish. And it's great to be here, back here again in Ovale. A marvellous venue with marvellous people. And congratulations to everybody who did the five-word challenge. I was absolutely gobsmacked by them. Absolutely amazed by the creativity and the space that you found between those words. So, if it's okay, I'll start with a little poem, Ascoide. The poem is on Bunan Bui, which I've translated into English. I'll read the first verse in Irish, and I'll read my translation. The Bunan Bui is the yellow bittern, which I think is now extinct in Ireland. Written by a man called Cathal Bui Mí Gura Gunna, who lived between 1690 and 1756. And he was Cathal Bui Mí Gura Gunna because yellow Cathal Mí Gura Gunna. We were taught when we were little boys going to a secondary school in the Soul, St. Michael's College, that he was yellow because he had blonde hair. Gura bollocks. He was yellow because he was drinking himself to death and his liver was jaundiced and his skin was yellow. But they wouldn't tell us that, we were all little pioneers at the time. But anyway, the story is that he was coming home from a drinking session up in the north of Ireland by Lake Vesey. And it was a frozen night, and he saw this yellow bittern dead beside the lake. He was dead because he concluded that he couldn't get a drink. And Cathal Bui decided that whatever would kill him, it wouldn't be for reasons of lack of drink. So if it's okay, I'll quote, which I know off by heart, I'll quote the first eight lines. Probably the most musical poem I know. It's absolutely astounding and beautiful in Irish. And then I'll try to replicate the Irish in my English translation. A bonan vi shem a liam the lee is the canava sheen to thresh the green is can aspa be a dee di a dog in lee or cool the keen. Is massilum hain os this the tree, to veid lea lack alone, is not nana to dee na dolig se tear, is na rala fian na ishka paul. Bitter bird, it is to say, after all your spree, your bones stretched dead, not hunger, no, by thirst laid low, flattened here on the back of your head. It's worse than the ruin of Troy to me to see you stretched among bare rock, who never did harm nor treachery, preferring water to finest hock. My lovely bird, I sorely grieve to see you stretch beside my path, where you would swill and drink your fill, and from the puddle I'd hear you rasp. Everyone warns your brother Cathal that the drink will kill him, to stop and think. But that's not so. Observe this crow, lately dead for want of drink. My youthful bird, I'm so depressed to see you stretched among the gorse, and the rats assembling for your waking to sport and pleasure by your corpse. And if you'd only sent a message that you were in a fix and dry, I'd have split the ice upon Lake Vesey, you'd have wet your mouth and your craw inside. It's not for these birds that I'm mourning, the blackbird, song thrush, or the crane, but my yellow bittern, a hearty fella, like me in colour, habit, name. He was ever drinking, and so am I, they say I'm cursed. There's no drop I'm offered, that I won't scoff for fear that I might die of thirst. Give up the booze, my darling begs me, twill be your death. Not so, I think. I correct my dear's delusion. I live longer the more I drink. Look at this smooth-throated tippler, dead from drought beside me here. Good neighbours all, come wet your whistles, for in the grave you'll drink no beer. I write a lot of sonnets. I suppose it was John B. Keane that got me on the road to sonnets, first of all. I come from a little village called Myvan, which is 7 miles from the Stole, on the Limerick border, but on the Kerry side of it, the good side of it. And I don't mean that. And John B. many years ago was at us when I was younger, in my 30s. We should address form again to start writing sonnets. And John Dee actually, he told a story one time about Sabbath as well, being 1490s, you know, they're not too long, so they're not too handy. And there was a tinker man, a travelling man called Jackie Faulkner, who used to drink with John Lee's. And when John Lee was writing his columns in the newspapers back in the 1970s and 80s, Jackie used to give him, the travelling man used to give him stories of his travels on the roads. And this evening, Jackie went into John Lee's, and John Lee was in his own in the bar reading a book. And John Lee stood with a pint of Guinness and left Faulkner to his own devices. And Faulkner got bored after a while. He said, "John Lee," says he, "do you mind me asking you," he said, "what you're reading?" "Oh," said John Lee, "that's a long poem by Brendan Kennedy. It's called The Island Man." To which Faulkner replied, "Christ, kid," he said, "poetry is bad enough without it being long." So here's 49s, you know. As I said, I write a lot of sonnets, and I published a little book of sonnets from which this is taken. My father died about 17 years ago, my mother had very bad health all her life. She had a rheumatic fever as a child, but the result of heart was never any good. And from the time virtually that I was born, her heart gave out. And she had to have an operation when I was about 3. The top surgeon in the country at the time, the top heart surgeon, was a man from Skull, County Cork, called Maurice Hickey. And he had this operation which was available in America, which he had learned how to do. That he opened the mitral valve, what was wrong with my mother's heart. And he opened the heart and he inserted his finger into the mitral valve to expand it, and all he could do was close the heart again and let the heart expand, let the expansion last as long as it would. But anyway, my mother was an invalid. My mother and father had a shop in the village, grocery shop, and my father ran the shop because my mother couldn't. He cooked in the kitchen, he sewed, he darned, he washed, he scrubbed, he made the beds, he did all of those things. And nearly 20 years ago, the Sunday Independent ran a feature on the new man. Now you must understand that the new man is a wonder. He can change a nappy, and he can fix a baby's bottle and push a buggy, but squirt is rocket science. But anyway, I said, you know, my father did all those things for us when I was a small boy. And my mother lived till I was 21. He did all those things right through my life. So I wrote this sonnet for him, and here it is. It's called Dad. A man before his time, he cooked and sewed, took care of me and Nanny in her bed, stayed in by night and never hit the road. I remember well the morning she was dead. I've been living up in Artle, my first job. I hit the road in patches coming home. He came down from her room, began to sob, "Oh, Gabriel, 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 Mam is gone." He held me and I told him not to cry. I loved her too, but thought this not the place. I went up to her room, cried softly, "Why?" Then touched her head quite stiffly, no embrace. Now when the new man poses with his kid, I think of all the things my father did. And I write children's poems as well, and I'm told by everybody who buys them that the adults buy them for the children, but they read them for themselves first of all. They seem to get a kick out of them. This is a poem that I wrote based on a story written by my son John. John was 9 when my father died, and he was heartbroken. And he was going around the place moping and moaning for weeks afterwards. And I said, "John, why don't you write about your grandfather? Because if you had to get it off your chest." He said, "No, he was too sad to write." So I said, "Oh, here's a tape recorder, talking to the tape recorder." So he spoke into the tape recorder about his grandfather, spoke for about 5 minutes, and he kept the tape. Radio Kelly, our local radio station, maybe a few months afterwards, ran a competition for children to write about their best friend. And John said to me, "You know, Dad, Granddad was my best friend." So John, if you like, he said, "You give me that tape. I type it out on the computer for you. You tidy it up. You send it into Radio Kelly and see how you get on." He did, and he won. And there were 5 winners. There was a winner for a Monday, a Tuesday, a Wednesday, a Thursday, and a Friday. Typical Kelly competition, 5 winners. But anyway, John, I was so impressed by John's story that I said, "John, can I make a poem out of your story?" And then a cute Kelly man, 9 years of age, said, "How much would you give?" So I said, "I'd give you 50 quid when the poem is published," which I did. So this is my best friend, my best friend John's story. My best friend was Grandad. I used to stay at his house on Friday nights, and that was great fun. He used to take me to the chipper after 9 o'clock news, and he'd buy 2 cartons of curry chips and 2 sausages, and we'd eat them in his kitchen during the Late Late Show. He used to come up to our house on Sundays for dinner, and I'd always want to sit beside him at the table. I remember one Christmas, I had just got a snooker table. Grandad came up for Christmas dinner, and I had asked everybody else to play with me. They all said no, they were too busy. Grandad was in the middle of setting the table, and I asked him to play, and he said he would. He came over, and I actually had to place the balls for him. It was so long since he had played snooker. Well, Grandad was my best friend. He was so kind. He was just unique to me. Like, he didn't know much Irish, because when he was young, he hadn't much time for school. He had to help at home on the farm, he said, and at 14 years had to hide himself with farmers, because he had 13 brothers and sisters and times were bad. But I often did my Irish homework with him, and he always ended up right. I remember the day Grandad died. It was March. I can't remember the date. He rang Mum and said he thought he was having a heart attack. We rushed down to his house. We got there in 2.5 minutes, and when we went in, we found Grandad lying on the floor, moaning. And then he just died. And I was below in the room crying, and then Mum and Nessa and Dad started crying too. At the funeral panel, I forgot myself and said, I'm sitting beside Grandad. But Grandad was in his coffin. He was dead. It was fine until they closed the coffin, and then I knew I'd never see him again in this life. Goodbye, Grandad, my best friend. Goodbye, goodbye. No, not to leave women out. My mother, an extraordinary woman. As I said, she had a rheumatic fever as a child, and the heart was never any good. And she lived till I was 21, however, and she went blind for a finish. But she was always interested in books. My father didn't have a good education, as you found out there at the school at 13. But my mother had, through a very sad journey in her life, she had a good education. Her father, my grandfather, also had heart trouble, died when she was 6. And the mother was left, my grandmother was left to raise a family of 11 children. And her son, my uncle Ben, came home from America. He'd done very well in America, and he set up a haulage business in my van at the time. New York Sanchez was called. And he had lorries driving stuff all over the place. I don't know if they ran on diesel or on petrol, I presume diesel. But anyway, one evening, my grandmother, my mother's mother, and her sister, my aunt, Kate, were in front of a fire, mixing petrol or diesel from one container to another, when it blew up and my grandmother had burned to death. Oh. My mother was 9 years of age, and she was an orphan. And the oldest sister, May, was 18. She wanted to be a nun, and that dream had to go out the window. She had to marry, and marry well, and very fast. So she chose a well-to-do businessman in the next village, Dinn County, Limerick, Mick Dalton, and she married him, and she reared the family. So my mother, through that reason, was sent to the Loreto Convent in Gorey, for her education after her primary school, which was in Glen. And she learned all sorts of things. She could speak French perfectly to the day she died. She could speak Irish, speak English. She was very good at all the arts and all that. And she passed on all that love to me. And she was very anxious that I would have a love for these things, because I would go to school, but I was bone idle. And she wanted me, she knew that I wouldn't be an abbey like my uncles and my father's brothers, that I'd have to get a handy job like a teacher. So she made sure that I learned my lessons. And this is years afterwards. She'd have loved to have seen, she had a great interest in poetry, she'd have loved to have seen a book of mine in print, but she didn't live to see it. So I wrote this villain out for my mother. It's called In Memory of My Mother. My mother lived for books, though nearly blind. An invalid, she read while she could see. The only pleasure left her was her mind. The books she read that pleased her were designed to strip her life down to a clarity. My mother lived for books, though nearly blind, while I'd read all the comics I could find. Confined to bed, she'd read good books to me. The only pleasure left her was her mind. Delighting in the vision of her kind, that second sight, the gift of poetry. My mother lived for books though nearly blind. Books I read from bookshelves that were lined with poems she'd recite from memory. The only pleasure left her was her mind. And I remembered, as I launched and signed the first slim poems of my maturity, how Mammy lived for books though nearly blind. The only pleasure left her, her mind. You're very kind, thank you very much. My son, 2 or 3, 4. I get the page first of all, on the boys there. 2 or 3, 4. John is an amazing old fella. He's 24 now. He's 26 now. And he was as bright as I was a primary teacher for 25 years. And I taught him in school in my life. And apart from the fact that he was a total handful, he was very good at maths. They have, in primary school, some of you would have remembered doing Sigma T tests, they're the standard maths tests. And he scored off the sheet every time. He was brilliant at them. But the result that he went to UL, to the University of Limerick, to study maths and economics, hated the sight of the maths he was learning there. Went to the pub in the campus and failed his first year. He'd been cooking in the meantime. He was always interested in cooking. And he worked in Allo's restaurant in the Seoul during the summers, which is one of the finest restaurants in Ireland. And he went back for his second year anyway, and he rang me up after a few weeks, and he said, "Daddy, I'm sick of this." I said, "What do you want to do, John?" He said, "I want to be a chef." I said, "Right, off you go, I teach ready for you." And Cahill Grove Street in Dublin. So he did, and he became a chef. And he worked in Allo's as a full-time chef, and then he worked in one of the finest blue book restaurants you'll get, the Mustard Street in Ballingally. And then he got chosen as one of the top 5 young chefs in the country for the Euro Top competition. And he is now the head chef in Milocknes, in Clontarf. The point I want to make is Briseann an Dubhas to Húlim an Cuic, that in the Irish it says that breeding breaks out in the eye of the cat. They're both adopted children, they don't mind me saying this. And when John was 21, his birth mother found him. And it turns out that I've known her husband for years. He owns a television company in Cúlé, and I work for him. And Shirley is her name, and we're very, very friendly. And John's birth grandfather, Tony Fahey, is still alive, and he was the head chef at the Park Hotel in Glendale. Amazing. So I wrote this for John when he left home, and again, it's a silent, so it's nice and short. To my son as he leaves home. Son, just to have you round the house is good. The way you make your presence felt. I miss the way that being with you was drinking food. The future beckons, now it's come to this. You're leaving, son, I wish you all the best. May every good that life can give be yours. Stand firm, love, and life becomes a test. Remember that the good you do endures. You're leaving, son, take all you need from me. It's freely given as it was when you needed me. A baby on my knee, needed me as to a man you grew. I love you, son, I shed a happy tear as I let you go in faith and hope and fear. And not to let out this, our daughter, an amazing girl altogether, mother of our 2 grandchildren, serving her partner, living in Castle Island, and they have a fantastic life. They have their own organic farm, and he's a carpenter as well. And she used to bring his eggs and cabbages and carrots from her organic garden. Marvellous. And then she told us when she was 19 she was pregnant, and I think she wasn't too happy with them. She was happy, but I thought she thought we wouldn't be too happy. But when I was told that she was going to be pregnant, my first response was, "Good, I'm going to be pregnant." So this is to my daughter pregnant, another son. She brings me eggs from chickens she has reared, cabbages and carrots she has grown. All the things about her for which I feared have come to naught, she's come to her own. She brings me eggs from chickens she has reared. Soon she'll be a mother. I rejoice. Daughter, from the moment you appeared, you gave me songs to sing in joyful voice. Soon you'll be a mother and you'll give not eggs just, but a grandchild to adore. Another reason for a man to live. for a grandchild that is blessings to our store. Pregnant with the life in which you bloom, you bless us with a child within your womb. And then, of course, Katie arrived. Katie Margaret Cowley, our granddaughter. She has a brother now called Paddy. But anyway, I remember holding Katie for the first time. And I was delighted. And all the old chickens in my life seemed to go out the door and nothing mattered, just that I had this gorgeous little blue-eyed, blonde-haired girl in my arms. Which was totally different to the time I first held John, our adopted son. Brenda told me, my wife told me, that I went a whiter shade of pale when I held John. And I can understand why. Because I remember when the nurse said to me, now here's your daddy. I said, oh shit, what am I after doing? This is the first thing you've done in your life, David, you can't get out of. You can get out of a marriage, you can get out of a job, but you can't walk away from a kid who calls you daddy again. Jesus, man, that's a big, big, big thing. But anyway, this is, I'm becoming a grandfather. When I say all the old nonsense in my life having disappeared, evaporated for a minute. I thought I loved until you came along. No other love can now become a threat. Love is faithful that everything goes wrong. There's nothing I have loved that I regret. I thought I loved until you came along. You freed me up to be myself. And now that I found my voice again in song, I sing that all that heaven will allow. I thought I loved until you came along. The ghost that haunted me I now call friend. I love all that I hid for far too long. When I think of you, Kate, all my old hearts mend. Never have I known a peace so strong. I thought I loved until you came along. I'll indulge myself now by reading one children's poem for you, another one. Not published yet, coming out from Liberty's Press next February. It's John. It's Katie. On the 17th of June, Father's Day last year, Paddy was born. And Katie was so excited. She'd known from the previous Christmas that she was going to have a baby brother or sister. And she was always going around the place telling everybody that she was going to have the baby, not her mother. But anyway, she had a sleepover the night before the boy was born, Paddy, and she called him Papa. And we went in the following morning to see our daughter and her partner and the kid. And Katie was full of the joys of this new baby until she saw him. And she suddenly held back. I wouldn't say she was frightened, but she was very shy. But after a while, she went over and she rubbed him and she patted him. And she did one of the nicest things I've ever seen. She went over to her little bag of toys. She took one of her own little teddies and gave Paddy his first present. I thought it was lovely. And I wrote this for her and for Paddy. A baby brother for Katie. The first time I saw Papa, I was very shy. But before long I got used to him and gave him for a toy one of my own teddies. I placed it by his head, but he was very fast asleep in his little bed. Yes, he was very fast asleep. I rubbed him once or twice, because he's my little brother and he's very nice. Yes, he's my little brother and we love him, yes. But still, I'm Dada's little girl, because I'm my dad's princess. Right, here's coming up to the end now. Hope I haven't delayed you too long. Wrong book. This one, 250. Brenda and myself are 34 years married, I think. And on our 30th wedding anniversary, I wrote this. You know the song is. And it's the one that gets me all the brownie points when I stay out too late and sing and dance and do the clown. And I can just remind her of this marriage thing I do for her, which is 20 years married. It's called Just to Be Beside You Is Enough. Just to be beside you is enough. Just to make your breakfast, tea and toast. To help you with the wire, that kind of stuff. Just to get the papers in your post. To hold you in my arms in calm embrace. Just to sit beside you with the fire. Just to trace my fingers in your face is more to me than all of youth's desire. Just to lie beside you in the night, to hear you breathe in peace before I sleep, to wake beside you in the morning light and the love we sow together that we reap. Together we have taken smooth and rough, just to be beside you is enough. Right. Can I try two new ones? They're short enough. I spent 35 years teaching, and I spent, in other words, all my life up to 7 years ago when I retired, under the vigilation of priests, inspectors, teachers, parents, board of management. They were all grand, except for flipping inspectors. I was pathologically afraid of inspectors when I was a kid, because the teachers, who were really afraid of the inspectors, transferred their fear onto us. And, you know, this is one of my freedom poems from inspectors.
Kingerophobia.
Shinigan. The inspector calls. The inspector calls. We all stand. Ta falls an oath. I take his hand. He flaunts his Irish. Mine is better. Then turns to English. Like a debtor, I fawn upon him while he goes through the books. Then strikes a pose as he probes my class to find out if I've been doing my job. And by God, he's stiff. I have done my job, no thanks to him. And those in power who on a whim deprive us of the things we need to teach our kids, because their greed broke this country and now we are in debt for all eternity. And still I come here day by day to teach these kids to live and pray. But prayer is now frowned upon by the commissars of education. The Inquisition over, it seems I've passed, myself and my faithful class. He turns to Irish once again. To me, Irish is a friend, but to him it's a means to show just who here is in control. He leaves my classroom, we all stand. Slán awaya, I take his hand. But I swear beneath my breath, it's men like him will be the death of all the things that I hold dear. The republic of conscience we have here, in this classroom where I teach and laugh and learn. By God, but each of these children deserve more than to be insulted by a board who thinks his schooling is a way to preserve the status quo. I pray for these children and for all whose backs are lately to the wall, crippled by austerity, that we can still stand proud and free. For freedom is that blessed state that's born with us, the tyrants hate, who use schooling to control what's innate in every soul. By God, but they won't control me, for in my classroom I am free. In my classroom. Wow. And, I'm totally apolitical, but the one political poem I've written is on the resignation of Rory Quinn as Minister of Education. He destroyed education. Not just him, but himself and his colleagues. But what will I say about this? I'm going around to schools. I retired from teaching 7 years ago, and I go around in the Rising Schools program for the Arts Council of Poetry Ireland. And every school I go into, it's the same damn thing I'm hearing. The 1999 curriculum, which came out, is overloaded. Teachers need more time to teach. They're not being given time to teach. They're being given extra hours to fill in forms. Ticking boxes, filling forms. They're all sick of it. And once again, the situation has been quadrupled now. There are no men in the classroom anymore. It's all women. And, you know, that's a good thing for women, but it's not a good thing for the profession. But anyway, I wrote this when Rory Quinn resigned. We're not happy till we're leaving the British. Or else it's Uncle Sam. Be it in economics or the way we run exams. When it comes to education, I'm glad that I got out, though I miss the children. There can be no doubt we're destroying education with boxes, notes and plans for the women who put up with it. You hardly see a man in the classroom any longer. They're chefs, they're engineers. They won't put up with the nonsense that the minister and his peers in the Department of Education foisted upon all who remain in the classroom, though there are some who won't play ball with their counterproductive system. Take a woman that I know, a school principal like the great ones that I knew long ago. She had a school inspection. The inspectors, as they do, turned the whole school upside down. Everything on view was ship-shape and in order, but there was no school plan written down in triplicate. The inspector, a little man, demanded the plan scudder, at which the old school head towered above that nothing. You're looking at it, she said. For there's much that's good in teaching that can't be written down. Education is the poorer for your having been around. And finally, Billy Keane John Deason, I shouldn't be calling him John Deason anymore, he's a writer on his own right now. And Nicky McConnell, who wrote Only Our Rivers Run Free, with an own hand, the former manager of the Irish soccer team. We do a pub theatre in John Dee's every Tuesday night during the months of July and August. And Billy always insists that I finish up with this. So I take Billy Keane as a good judge of what is a good poem to finish up with. This is a poem called Obsession. There's a story that goes around, not Kerry, was going around in the 60s and 70s, about this fellow in Ballybunion, which is, of course, you know, the big beach in North Kerry, where the ballroom is where we all got our first grope and our first kiss and all the rest way back. And the story is this fellow had an obsession with breaking windows with a catapult gun. Some of you will call it a slingshot, it's the same thing, it's a thing that is elastic on it. And he was breaking the windows, and the guards had to warn him that if he didn't stop, he'd be taken to Killarney. Killarney is a real old what you call in Cork once upon a time. Tony Baker. And there's another apocryphal story told about a Kerry man, a semi-literate Kerry man, about the same time, who was filling in a form, a green form. And the first thing that appeared on top of the form was name. He was able for that, John Michael Murphy. Second word appeared on top of the form, born. Thought about that for a while, he wrote down yes. And the third one that appeared on top of the form was sex. That was easy, once in Ballybunion. Anyway, obsession. And I'll finish with this, and thank you very much. He had a strange obsession. With catapult in hand, he went round breaking windows in the village by the strand, Ballybunion. The police there gave him warning they could tolerate no more, yet he went on breaking windows in the village by the shore. So they took him to Killarney, from the village by the sea, where they filled him up with tablets and a course of ECT. That fixed him, or it should have, but when the doctors asked him what he'd do when he got home, he'd answer with a laugh, "I'd get a catapult and I'd break every window in Ballybunion." So they keep him in Killarney, and every month or so, when they want to release him, they can't let him go, because he always answers with the same old mad refrain. Every time they let him out, his answer is the same, "I'd get a catapult and I'd break every window in Ballybunion." The months go by, he's still inside. The long stays ask him then why every time he's for release he's kept inside again. So he tells him of his answer, the truth of what he'll do once he's home in Ballybunion. The long stays tell him, "You. The next time you are asked that question, tell him that you'll get the paper for the horses and you'll put on the odd bit. And tell him you'll go dancing. Then they'll let you out. But if they mention catapults, shut your mouth." Time goes by, he's called again, he's ready this time, and he tells him what he'll do at home in the village by the strand. "I'd buy the morning paper, and I'd study the horses then, and I'd put on a bet or two. The strings cry out, good man. And I'd go to the dance," he tells him, "and I'd go dancing with a girl, and I'd take her out and court her." He says, "It's in a whirl. Good man, the old man. I'll take her out," he says, "and I'd kiss her, and then I'd put my hand inside her dress. Good man, the old man. And then what will you do? I'll take the knickers off her. And then what will you do? I'll take the knickers off her," he continues with a shout. "I take the knickers off and I'll rip the elastic out. I take the knickers off and I do what I've always done. I make a catapult in the elastic and I break every fucking window in the body. Thank you very much."